Yeah, Joe Biden, when he defeated Trump, he was hailed as an absolute messiah by the mainstream media around the world. It was a victory for common sense, good governance, and the stability of the world system. Headlines everywhere trumpeted the fact that America was back. He promised to introduce sensible COVID policies. There were discussions about how he would end racism, police brutality towards Black and brown people, expand voting rights, take action on climate change, and so on and so on. And he started out his term in office with a bang. They obviously had a plan. They passed a record number of executive orders in the first week or two, targeting all sorts of things, including trans rights, funding for Black farmers, masks in federal buildings, and a whole range of other things. He introduced the America's most diverse cabinet ever, including a Black woman as vice president. He talked a fair bit about trade unions and workers' rights, made the occasional jab against big business, and, you know, the acknowledgement that climate change was real obviously gave hope to many. But the key thing to all of this, and I'll talk more about it down the track, is that a lot of this stuff, in fact, all of it really, was tokenism at its finest. And it was an absolute example of symbolism over substance. But after 4 years of Trump, people were happy to hear even just, you know, rhetorical gestures of support to their causes and their preferred issues. And so this gave Biden quite a sheen coming in, a sheen that I think has still yet to wear off. But beneath the surface of all this kind of hysteria and liberal genuflections, things, I would argue, have changed far less than they appear. In fact, I would say that Biden has much more in common with Trump than he has really differences. On most of the issues that matter to working class people in America and around the world, including the future of our planet, Biden has to this point basically maintained Trump's policies. And nowhere does this manifest more obviously than in America's imperial rivalry with China, which Biden has just ramped up even further. And his only distinguishing feature from Trump is that he's actually a more aggressive rival to China. But the interesting thing about this is that despite Biden's policies being not so dissimilar on the whole, on the substance, to those of the Republicans, the American politics is extremely polarized, and in fact is more polarized now, perhaps, than under Trump. And you have hard and extreme right politics beginning to make inroads into Congress via the Republican Party. You have really extreme policies like the ban on abortion in Texas that's now being replicated in a whole range of states where the Republicans have control, and so on. And, you know, these kind of culture war issues around abortion, trans rights, critical race theory, and so on have become really pivotal to the Republicans' approach building an opposition to Biden. But it does go beyond that as well. And the context of this kind of situation, where you have a centrist, really reactionary in the form of Joe Biden, coming in and promising some basic liberal and, you know, centrist policies, seeming like an improvement, and you have an extremely and increasingly rabid right, has put a lot of pressure on the left, I think, and successfully really silenced the left, and to give the administration a pretty much blank check, which Bernie Sanders and the squad have been more than happy to do. And so I want to finish by looking at the impact of Biden on the left in America, but importantly also in Australia and around the world, where I think it matters a lot. Okay. So many of you will be too kind of young to remember Trump's election. And it was a massive shock to the system, both in America and globally. It threw up a whole range of political issues. The main one initially being the white working class turning Republican, shocked and appalled by democratic liberalism and progressivism, and attracted by Trump's sort of nativist bigotry. And this was a narrative that ran strong for years before polling actually eventually showed that it was pretty marginal to what had gone on. Internationally, Trump's policies shook up the world system, making a pretty radical departure in some ways from the approach of kind of global system management that America had taken to that point. They pulled out of trade agreements. They attacked close allies. They put tariffs on, you know, countries like Japan and Europe, who were meant to be America's buddies. And, you know, this was seen as a break. And some on the left actually even argued that Trump's so-called isolationism was actually a lesser evil to Clinton, John Pilger being the most famous that I remember. And we're really now in a position to make more sense of the Trump years than I think was possible at the time, or at least was possible for the mainstream. Really, Trump was the metastasization of right-wing republicanism that had been developing for decades under, you know, Reagan, then Gingrich, through the 80s and 90s. The racist paranoia of the war on terror, stoked by Bush and accepted wholeheartedly, really, by the Democratic Party at the time. And then the Tea Party insanity under Obama, where you had substantial chunks of the American population believing that Obama was a Muslim, that he wasn't born in America, and that he was actually sympathetic to Al-Qaeda and so on. And these kind of crazy conspiratorial drift to the right was really given its backbone by the Christian evangelical movement, which has been growing substantially and very deliberately politically for decades. There was a really good article in a recent ISJ about that, International Socialism Journal. Okay, what unifies each generation or iteration of this kind of Republican right that's shifted increasingly to insanity has been its social base. This is largely, but not exclusively, but largely outside of major cities. Largely, again, not exclusively, middle class in its core, though it does have some appeal beyond that to blue-collar types. It's predominantly white, although, again, not exclusively, and there is, in particular, a layer of Latinos who are open to some of the social conservatism via their Christianity. But, you know, this is a very reactionary social base, and this social base and the Republican Party's genuflections towards it have resulted in some enormous damage to American society. Some of the basic economic policies are known, the ravaging of America's already meager welfare state, attacks on the right to organize in unions, undermining the ability of women to access abortions, racial minorities to have basic rights, other oppressed groups, you know, to access trans medical services and so on. And some of the biggest ones really are just the basic access to democratic expression, such as even the right to vote. But we should be clear that despite all these attacks and the histrionic culture wars that sort of have gone alongside many of them and some of the populist rhetoric, the Republican Party, their main program to this point has focused on helping the rich get richer. That's been, all of this stuff has been a sideshow to really that core agenda. And you've seen enormous tax cuts all the way through in favor of the rich, despite the populist rhetoric. And so Biden comes in the context of all that, and it doesn't take a lot to give people hope that things are going to improve. And I want to go into some detail about, I think, the ways in which that has not happened. So, you know, the 2020 saw, it was 2020, wasn't it? The Black Lives Matter movement, the biggest protest movement measured by participants in America's history, probably in world history, you know, a radical movement in some ways demanding justice for the thousands of people murdered by police, Black people murdered by police, annually in the US. Biden never really supported the movement, but he made noises, sympathetic noises. In office, he has come out in favor of increasing funding to the police and offered advice as to how that could be done. He's refused to make any reform measures to the police force at a federal level. It's been a total snub to that whole movement. So on that, it's been a total failure. On the climate, Biden, of course, signed up to the Paris Accords, which have been widely denounced as useless, and is attempting to set up to lead the world at COP26. In fact, Biden has already organized an international conference around climate in April this year, which was a talk fest that achieved absolutely nothing. In the meantime, underneath the surface of all this huffing and puffing, he's actually expanded the drilling for oil and gas in the US, and actually approvals for new fields on federal land, which was the thing that he promised to pause, they've been given out at the highest rate for decades under his administration. And so we have to understand that Biden's rhetoric on this score has been totally for public consumption, with very little of it manifesting in any kind of change to climate renewables or sustainability. On the question of borders and immigration, it's become something, well, it was something of a meme briefly, the fact that he had maintained all of Trump's policies, and that the only real change was that AOC was calling the torture camps for children complex over capacity facilities or something. But that remains the case, despite the fact that the liberal press are not interested in covering that story. Children are still being separated from their families in enormous numbers by the policies. There is still a freeze on processing illegal arrivals. And actually this year, there was the lowest ever number of refugees brought into America. The Washington Post reported up to the 9 months to July 31st that only 6,246 people were given refugee visas to America in 9 months. That is the lowest ever, substantially lower than Trump's worst ever figure. And Biden has now talked about accepting a slightly tweaked version of Trump's Remain in Mexico policy, which, for those who don't know, was basically a plan to say that nobody could cross the border, that you would have to wait in Mexico before getting a visa, which was in America had never been the case. You could come in and then seek asylum in the country. He's planning to go back to that, which is basically a version of Australia's offshore detention processing regime. So absolutely zero progress on this score. Early in Biden's term, the media were running big headlines about his presidency being the most transformative since Roosevelt and the New Deal of that era. And 9 months on, things have been very underwhelming on that score. Since the initial stimulus bill, which was reduced from what Trump did, which was actually less than what Trump did the previous year and less than what Biden promised in his campaign, there's been basically nothing. There's been no long-term investment in welfare, healthcare or public services. There are a few bills going that are sort of stuck in Parliament at the moment in the Congress, and it's unclear whether or not they will succeed. But to be clear, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill is woefully inadequate to rebuild key amenities and does nothing to seriously tackle climate change. And the $3.5 trillion welfare bill looks pretty stuck. And there's not a lot of urgency about pushing it through that I can see. It's already underwhelming in many ways, and it can be pretty much guaranteed that it'll be cut further. And even the first draft of the bill that was released this week, which serves as a sort of progressive ambit claim, contains only a partial reversing of Trump's tax cuts on the rich. So corporate taxes, after Biden's historic transformative reform, will actually still be below what they were when Trump was elected, their lowest level. And he'll do nothing to tax capital gains or large inheritances, which is some of the main ways actually the rich make their money. They don't earn income the way we do. They make capital gains off investments. Okay. They're also talking about reintroducing a tax avoidance measure designed to help millionaires in blue states compensate for the fact that those states tend to have higher taxes on the rich. Now, the Financial Times estimated that the wealthiest 0.1% of individuals would gain an average of $145,000 per year from this measure. $145,000 for the richest 0.1%. For the middle 60% of households, they would benefit $27 a year from this reform. So according to the Financial Times, this is actually a more aggressive tax measure than anything Trump passed. And that's what the Republicans are calling middle-class tax relief and trying to jam it into a supposedly transformative, redistributive Keynesian welfare policy. And so overall, we have to say, while Biden's promising to spend a bit more on infrastructure and slightly boost some welfare payments, his overall policies will barely impact, let alone transform, the incredibly unequal status quo that he inherited. Two additional issues that I think are crucial. COVID. So Trump was rightly perceived as a lunatic, advocating bleach injections and so on. And the US saw some of the highest rates of COVID last year, both in terms of infections and deaths. And Biden saw many take a sigh of relief that finally there'd be a competent adult in charge. But I think if you look a bit closely, it's hard really to see what has changed. There has not been a single national lockdown in America, despite cases running into the hundreds of thousands at various points. There's been no national mask mandate. Biden has been too cowardly to risk taking on the states and having a fight about the right of the federal government to impose the most basic health measures on society. And in fact, Biden actually offered more funding to schools on the proviso that they opened up earlier than they wanted to, when it was still too dangerous. That's been one of Biden's real innovations, to get people back to school despite it not being safe. The vaccine policy did not change under Biden. The so-called ramping up of vaccine distribution was begun under Trump. It had nothing really to do with Trump or Biden. It was just a normal functioning of the American state, handing out money to big business to do research that's vital so they can profit off that. That was well underway under Trump. Biden benefited from the vaccine rollout. But, you know, while Biden has been obviously pro-vaccine in a general sense, and some Republicans have not, this is hardly progressive politics. Pretty much every right-wing politician in the world is pro-vaccine, with the exception of some freaks. So nothing's really changed under Biden at all with the public health measure. And actually, Biden has been trumpeting the ability for all Americans to access booster doses, which medically are highly unproven. And just today, just like a couple of days ago, the FDA came out against that, saying that it's more important to vaccinate poor people in the third world while there's a global shortage than waste time vaccinating otherwise healthy and safe people in America, which is presented as an attack on Biden's health policy, because Biden is as much American chauvinist as Trump ever was. Okay, so Biden's maintained the COVID policies. He's maintained, and so there's a situation in America where every 2 days about as many people die from COVID as died on 9/11, with absolutely none of the shock, none of the emergency policies introduced, and so on. And while it would be unwise to make predictions about the pandemic and its impact on American politics and American society, alongside the economy, it's going to play a huge role in shaping Biden's future and his prospects in the midterm. The other main thing that I wanted to talk about in terms of Biden's policies so far is foreign policy. Of all the aspects of the Biden administration, it's really the one that deserves the closest attention, because I think it matters most for the world and Australian politics in particular. I don't think it matters much for the world, to be honest, if the welfare system is improved slightly. I don't think it's going to decisively shape anything. What will decisively shape the world is Biden's approach to foreign policy, which I think is risking a catastrophe. Now, Trump was known for his America First approach to world politics. He pulled out of numerous free trade agreements. He imposed tariffs on a range of goods. He promised to withdraw troops from Afghanistan and undermined long-standing allies, as I said. But the most dramatic innovation that Trump introduced was really the front-on sort of rhetorical assault on China. And at the time, it's sort of hard to remember, but for those of us who were kind of organizing at the time, it was quite shocking. This kind of direct great power kind of confrontation really had not been seen for some time. And the complacent establishment actually thought this was over the top. Initially, the Democrats were kind of worried about this as destabilizing and so on. But at the heart of this perspective was a longstanding idea given new force by Trump, but having a long history in the US, that America was being too generous with its foreign aid, carrying too much of the cost for maintaining world peace, and needed to play a more aggressive, unilateral role of enriching itself come what may. Now, of course, there's many retorts to this. No one had ever asked America to play the role of world police. But regardless, the perception of US withdrawal did create some anxiety among its allies and joy for some of its enemies. And in particular, it gave China some scope to expand its influence somewhat through some free trade agreements, more aggressive diplomacy, and so on. Here in Australia, while the Liberal Party felt a great ideological affinity with Trump, by the end of his tenure, he'd clearly become an embarrassment. His cavalier and incompetent approach to diplomacy and world politics was an issue for them, especially as they saw China beginning to stretch its wings. And under his leadership, America seemed incapable of responding coherently. And so for global imperialism, in particular the imperialism that's allied with America, Biden coming in was meant to be a great reset to this kind of madness. The educated imperialist strategists would be back in charge. The FBI and CIA, who'd been maligned by Trump and were seen as part of the resistance by the Democrats, remember, would be back in the driver's seat of global foreign policy. And Biden did a lot to assure the world that America was back. He visited a number of world leaders, gave them big hugs, friendly handshakes, that kind of thing. He signed up to the Paris Agreement, as I said. He organized a climate conference and generally went around doing a lot of smiling. But when the dust settled and we look a bit closer, once again, things have remained more or less on track as they were under the Trump administration. For example, though Biden was fated for rebuilding relations with allies, the Trump-era tariffs on steel and aluminium remain in place, as do some others, on a range of goods. The most important foreign policy, of course, issue is China, where Trump raised the level of tensions with China. Biden has not taken a backward step. And as we've seen this week with the submarine pact, Biden's actually escalated the situation with China. There's only a handful of countries in the world with nuclear submarines, and Australia is now spending tens of billions of dollars to join that murderous club. And really, what this is, and the analysis is just coming left, right, and center, this is just an extension of the US military. This is America's just subcontracting its military to the Australian state, funded by Australian taxpayers. We're going to be building machines of death so that we can assist America in dominating the Asia Pacific. And this is just one broader turn of the Biden administration to more seriously containing and isolating China to prevent it getting in a position where it can challenge US hegemony in the Asia Pacific region, or what is now called the Indo-Pacific region, because India is an ally, whereas Asia connotes China. And so that's why they withdrew from Afghanistan. There's lots of rubbish talked about that withdrawal. And yes, it was a defeat. And yes, it was clearly a humanitarian scandal. But this was an irrelevant war that was lost in any real sense almost a decade ago. The Americans knew it, and their strategists, it was just a matter of time before they pulled out. Afghanistan is no threat to America, nor is it of any real significance. And even the talk about Afghanistan being on China's border, it shares an extremely narrow land border, which is almost, you know, it's extremely impassable. This is not some porous key strategic region on the flank of China. It's a bit of a dead zone, really. And Afghanistan, from the perspective of the imperial strategist, was always just a stepping stone to a broader ambition to reshape the Middle East. But those plans were defeated years ago by the resistance forces in Afghanistan and Iraq. And so really this decision was just the end of an era that, you know, in any meaningful sense ended many years ago. China, on the other hand, is the future from an imperial point of view. They pose the first real challenge to American hegemony in its entire history. As someone pointed out yesterday, even the USSR was never a threat to America in any meaningful sense. Its economy was a joke. The regions that it controlled were getting poorer with every passing year and not richer, as wealth was extracted to keep Russia going. China's very different. China is growing and potentially enriching those who decide to work with it alongside it. And so the difference between Trump and Biden is not particularly a matter of aggression or agenda or even or approach to foreign politics. The difference is that Biden is competent. Biden is trying to get U.S. allies on board. Biden is bringing us closer to war than Trump ever could, because it was much less likely that people would follow Trump's bumbling, incoherent ramblings than they will the more savvy, calculating moves of Joe Biden. And in this context, I think the meager social spending that Biden is doing appears in a new light. Rather than being some broad shift to the left and representing some hope for progressive change in the US, it is really an attempt to try and stabilize the home front and give the US a firmer footing for its imperial exploits abroad. And it's no real accident that the Democrats who are most known for their substantial social spending were also those either preparing for or engaged in substantial wars. And here you think of LBJ, Vietnam, and the Great Society, I think it was, and Roosevelt and the New Deal and World War II. Okay, this matters a lot here in Australia. Both major parties are absolutely committed to the US alliance to their dying breath. And you can see the extent of it when even during Trump's weirdest and wackiest moments, the Australian government and the opposition remain totally silent. We were the most loyal defenders of Trump, apart from Israel, the world over. For example, Boris Johnson criticized Trump on multiple occasions, calling him out of his mind on one case, said that he displayed stupefying ignorance on another, attacked him for the Muslim ban, for instigating the Capitol riots, and so on. Australia has been silent. Australia, refused to go out on a limb to condemn Trump for anything that he's done. But the difficulty for the Australian ruling class was, despite their cynical apologism for Trump, there's actually a long history of suspicion towards the US alliance in this country. And Bush's wars in the Middle East obviously raised that to high heights. And Trump's bumbling bigotry really entrenched that. And some polls showed a 20-point shift in people's attitudes to the US in polls when people were specifically questioned about Trump and America versus when the question was asked in a more general sense about America. So Trump was a disaster for the Australian ruling class's US alliance, politically speaking. And from our perspective, this was a good thing. It's much better to have an incompetent and despised enemy than one that knows how to spin their measures. And so now that Biden is in charge, actually, anti-US sentiments are falling. When Trump was talking about coming to Australia, we were planning enormous demonstrations across Australia. We seriously believed, and I think it would have happened, we would have got thousands and thousands and thousands of people onto the street. I think if Biden visited Australia today, it would be inconceivable that there would be such demonstrations. I don't know who, apart from the far left, would even think protest this guy, which is a massive problem. Even the Greens reflect this kind of issue and the new mood. Adam Banse rightly condemned the nuclear submarines deal, which is good, but he praised Biden on multiple occasions in the same interview on the ABC that I heard on Thursday morning. He repeatedly argued that one of the main risks of the deal was that it would lock in Australia to the US alliance, which wasn't so much a problem now, but if Biden lost and Trump got elected, well, that would become a devastating issue because you can't rely on Trump and the Republican Party are going off the rails. So this implicitly is a defense of Bidenism and the alliance as it currently stands. And as well, in a similar point, he argued that Biden was leading the world on climate investments, which is a total lie, while Australia was spending all of its money on submarines. And so you can see if the Greens, which formally have a policy of calling to an end to the US alliance, it's probably their single best policy on their books. If even the Greens are totally capitulating in front of a man who is bringing us closer to World War III than anyone ever before, then you can see the political impact on the broader left in Australia. Okay, this shift in sentiment towards America under Biden is a global one, yes. And Tom Bramble points out in an article in the latest MLR, it's not just Australia. In polling done in 12 US allies, the percentage of people with a favorable view of America jumped from 37% in 2020 to 61% in 2021. This is a massive shift, 24 points in 1 year. And so this will make it much harder to turn anti-war sentiment into street mobilizations and organizing, which is going to be absolutely necessary in coming years. In, you know, if we weren't locked down now, I think we would have called snap actions against the submarine deal for sure. And we're going to need to do stuff like that going forward. But if the pressure to back Biden has neutralized a big chunk of progressive opinion around the world, it's even more the case in America. And I spoke before about the damage the Republicans have done to US society, where workers, the poor, and people of color have paid the cost. But for the Democratic Party, the situation is much more mixed. As the right have grown increasingly more deranged, the Democratic Party's hegemony over the broad liberal and progressive left has grown deeper and deeper. And the massive turnout achieved by Biden in 2020 really reflects this fact. Joe Biden is a Washington drone. He lacks any personality whatsoever. More importantly, he's a decades-long conservative with a pro-war and anti-working class record. It defies all reason that this guy was able to mobilize a record turnout in 2020. But the fear of another Trump presidency was a powerful mobilizer. And it's important to understand that that fear did not end in that election. It's a far too useful fear for the Democratic Party. Lesser evilism is a trick that prevents those who accept it from mobilizing for a better world. If you don't like Biden's support for oil drilling, you don't like Biden's support for the police, you think his treatment of asylum seekers on the border is inhumane, what are you going to do? If you cause too much trouble, you'll end up with a Republican who'll be even worse. And this pressure of lesser evilism will continue to grow as the right continues to become more and more insane. And recent articles in the Washington Post have reaffirmed the importance of Trump and lesser evilism to Democratic Party strategy. I couldn't resist. This quote blew my mind. It said, "This year, one of the chief worries in the party has been how to energize and excite voters in the post-Trump era. With Trump no longer in office, Democrats have concluded that the onus is on them to inject him into the campaign." So Trump is no longer an office bearer in any level of the country, but the only thing the Democrats can do to run against is to run against a man who's not even running for office. Truly inspiring. But if lesser evilism wasn't enough, then the behavior of Bernie Sanders and AOC and the squad has been also crucial to neutralizing left opposition to Biden. Bernie Sanders was given the important role of being the head of the Senate Budget Committee, which means he is the one who writes the bills that enact Biden's policies, including funding the police, limiting tax credits, and so on. So recently he wrote an article for the Time magazine celebrating Biden's status as one of the world's 100 most influential people, in which he described Biden as a transformative and unprecedented president. So really, Bernie Sanders is Biden's pet poodle. And for her part, AOC wasn't even worthy of getting an official position. She was never given a position. She was actually thwarted from taking a position on an important committee. But she still serves the Democrats well by acting as a sort of tame mascot, gearing up the base to cheer the government and boo the Republicans as her pathetic stunt at the Met Gala, an event for billionaires, shows. And as a result, Sanders and AOC have totally failed to criticize Biden on any substantive question, focusing their fire on the Republicans, proving that despite their occasional references to socialism, which, to be honest, I haven't heard in some time, they are basically garden variety Democratic Party stooges. And a similar thing has happened to the Democratic Socialists of America. 2 years ago, it committed itself rhetorically to splitting with the Democrats and building an independent Socialist Workers' Party at some point in the future. But the most recent party congress overturned that decision and committed themselves to the Democrats forever. And in a whole range of issues, they've reduced their horizons to those set by the Biden administration's campaign promises. So their main campaigns at the moment are for the PRO Act, which is a bit of pro-union legislation which Biden supports. And on immigration, their main practical proposal calls on Biden to carry out the promises he made in his campaign. And For this reason, and there are others, but for this reason, the organization is something of a crisis, with fewer dues paying members, fewer new signups, and way fewer people participating in its internal life. Which is not to say that it's collapsing, but it lacks any clear purpose for existence. It is just yet another part of the Democratic Party's liberal wing. But the impact of lesser evilism manifests in other ways too, less tangible, like the recent ban on abortions in Texas. I feel like if that had happened under Trump, there would have been demonstrations all across the country immediately, like we saw with the travel bans. As it stands, there will be demos on October the 2nd, but that's, you know, how they go is yet to be seen. Okay, given these huge issues, I think it is a disaster that the left currently has been totally neutralized in the US and globally. The COVID crisis, climate change, and now imperial tensions with China escalating to new heights, there is a crying need for a principled and radical left opposition to Biden in the US and globally. And the starting point for building this kind of opposition is a clear Marxist analysis which says that what the Biden and the Democratic Party represent, which is they are the party of heavy industry, big pharma, big finance, Silicon Valley, and of course, war. And I would argue that the world is actually much less safe now under Joe Biden than it was under Donald Trump, with the nuclear deal and the growing US presence in Asia. And even the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which is probably the only good thing Biden's done, was actually initiated by Trump, not by Biden. And so the left needs to reject the cynical liberalism of the Democratic establishment as much as we reject the odious reactionary politics of the Republican opposition. And that applies here in Australia as much as anywhere else. It is deeply mistaken for Bant and others to be pleased with the US alliance when Biden is in charge, but worried about the prospect of a Trump reversion. This kind of thinking reflects illusions in the liberal wing of the US ruling class that are totally unwarranted. The problem with the US alliance and the Biden administration is not that the US can't be relied on to fight for its interests globally, but that it's all too likely to do just that, and that the US alliance will mean working class people in Australia and around the world will die for corporate profits and power. And I'll leave it.